Good morning. It's all right like this? Okay. Marjorie, thank you for inviting me back. Always a pleasure. And in particular, this time, it's a pleasure because the topic we're going to be talking about this morning is one that I addressed in a drasha, in a sermon I gave on Yom Kippur. And it's one that I've been looking for an opportunity to speak about a little bit more. What is happening to the lights?
Save it.
Yeah, there you go. Knowing the topic, the lights are flying higher, I think. Yeah. That way people can read the sheets easier. By the way, I still have a couple of the sheets here if anybody needs. I'm good? Okay. All right. So, yes, our topic is Satan or Satan in Judaism. And, as a kid, I thought that was a Christian concept. I had no idea that was a Jewish thing. For my generation, the touchstone for Satan or Satan would have been Dana Carvey's character on Saturday Night Live. Various cartoon characters with, you know, red suits and pitchforks and a tail with a spike at the end, like that. And, you know, horns, of course. Let's not forget the horns, because if you have horns, you're one of three things, right? You either a ram, a Jew, or Satan. Those are your choices. But actually, it is a Jewish concept. And what I want to talk about is what it is and what it's supposed to mean. Who is Satan, Satan? What kind of creature is this? And I'll show you something interesting. We have to walk over to the board. So these numbers have relevance for Rosh Hashanah. Anybody know why? 30, 30, and 40.
Which way?
Add up 100. How much weight you gained over this many days, right? This was Thursday, this was Friday, this is Shabbos. No, that's not quite what I had in mind. Yes. Shofar blowing. Right? Traditionally, the way we blow the shofar is that we first blow 30 blasts before the Musaf Amidah. 30 more during the Musaf Amidah, either the silent part or the repetition, depending on your custom, and then 40 more at the end for a total of 100. Now, the Talmud notes that really the minimum obligation is just 30. You only need 30. So the question is, why are we blowing 100? So, leaving aside the last 40, because that actually is own class, discuss why we have the 40 in the end. But I don't want to go there right now because we have a lot to discuss. But these two 30s, really, the only one that's so to speak, the mitzvah one, as generally understood, is this one. The middle set, 30, the ones that we blow during the Amidah. The ones that are blown with the brachot, with the blessings of the Amidah, those are actually the essential ones. And so Talmud asks, then why am I blowing 30 in the beginning? And the answer it gives, strange as it sounds, is source number one on your sheet. The Talmud asks, why do we blow tkiah and truah, sounds of the shofar, when we are sitting and when we are standing? Why do we do it first when we are, this is the one that's called sitting? I know that most synagogues don't sit during shofar, but this is called the sitting part, because technically you could. We stand out of respect for the mitzvah. But you could sit at this stage. Why do we go over sitting and then again over standing? And the answer is larbevet ha-satan, to confuse Satan, Satan. Satan is the Hebrew term, Satan is the popular one. So what in the world are you talking about? Did anyone ever hear of this, that you're blowing the shofar multiple times in order to confuse the, like, what in the world could this even mean? It's a perplexing idea. And so that's where I want to go with this. You know, the whole idea of a satan, of a Satan. The classic Christian idea is, of course, that he is a rebel. Within Christian thought, Satan is a rebellious right? You've read or heard of Paradise Lost, right? So contrary to popular belief, Paradise Lost is not what appears in the Bible, not the Jewish one and not the Christian one. I think it was George Bernard Shaw who said that. He said people read Paradise Lost and think that that's what's in their Bible. But nonetheless, here is source number two. Slight excerpt. I modernized the spelling and turned it into English of today. But this is when this Satan, this angel, is consigned to live in the netherworld. So he says, "Is this the region? Is this the soil? The clime?" Said then the lost archangel, "This the seat that we must change for heaven? This mournful gloom for that celestial light?" Right? Are we consigned, we, him and his followers, to live down in hell? He says, "Be it so, since he who now is sovereign can dispose and bid what shall be right, farthest from him is best." I'd rather be far away from God, whom reason has equaled, force has made supreme above his equals. Meaning, I am his equal in terms of my mind, my intellect. Satan says I'm God's equal, but God has all the power, and therefore he is able to be superior, and therefore he is able to banish me from heaven. The Christian version of Satan, of Satan, is that he is a rebel, and he is a fallen angel, and he is cast down, and he's working against God. The Talmud's version of it is not at all so clear-cut, and in fact doesn't seem to paint him as a rebel at all. The clearest statement in the Talmud about Satan is source number three. A very brief sentence. It says, "Hu Satan, hu Malach HaMavet, hu Yetzer Hara." He is the Satan, he is the Malach HaMavet, he is the Yetzer Hara. I deliberately did not translate the terms. What is the Malach HaMavet? The Malach HaMavet? Angel of death. Angel of death. His job is kill people. Right, that's his job. Yetzer Hara. What is the Yetzer Hara's job? Sorry, to convince people to do bad things. Right? To convince people to do bad things. To get people to sin. Okay, so you have one, which is a murderer. You have one whose job is to get people to do the wrong thing. And then you have Satan. That means Satan is neither of those. So what is he? He's a devil. Okay, what does a devil do all day? He has a pitchfork, right? What does he do? We actually don't know anything about a pitchfork. That's not ours. Yes?
Where does the
Dybbuk
come in?
Ah, good question. So the Dybbuk actually has nothing to do with him. The concept of the Dybbuk is in origin very likely not necessarily ours. May have been absorbed from elsewhere. But the idea of a Dybbuk, the word in Hebrew, Dalet Bet Kuf, right? Dabek is, anybody know? To stick to something, right? When you're in kindergarten and they give you the paste or the glue, they call it Dabek, yeah. Right? So it's what a Dybbuk is supposed to be, is a soul that didn't end up going to heaven and didn't end up going to get, you know, either. And it's in some form of a limbo, and it returns to this world and enters somebody else's body to stick to the soul that's there. That's the idea of a Dybbuk. And again, whether that's a Jewish idea or a Christian idea that we borrowed or something entirely different is a really good question, but it's not relevant for Satan. So what's left in the job description? He's not killing people, he's not getting people to sin. What exactly does he do all day?
Nothing?
Oh, no. I think it's the other way around, right? Idle hands are the devil's work or something like that, right? So it's when we're idle. He's not idle. So what is he? And why do you keep calling him a male, by the way? No fair. So let's figure this out. And the way I like to address it is by looking at three stories in Tanakh in which Satan plays a role. The word Satan itself shows up sometimes in Tanakh as a being, which are the ones we're going to talk about, but sometimes as a verb. The term Satan, I'll write that on the board. The term Satan as a verb means to obstruct, to block. If you're familiar with the story of Bilam and the donkey, right? Bilam is a sorcerer of sorts who wants to attack the Jews verbally. He wants to curse them. He wants to pray to God to harm the Jews. He's hired to do that. On his way to do his job, he's riding on his donkey, and his donkey suddenly sees a malach, an angel of some kind, which is standing on the road of the Satan lo, to block the path for him. That's the first time biblically that we find the use of the word Satan, and it means to obstruct. But other times, three times in particular, we find the term Satan used to refer to a being. The first story involves David HaMelech, King David. And it's a story from the book of Shmuel Bet, Samuel 2. It's really a shame. Kids tend to learn this book, Samuel 2, Shmuel Bet, in school, but they never get to the end. And this is from the end of the book, so people are not familiar with it. But the way the story develops, it begins in chapter 20 and then it picks up in chapter 24. So take a look at source number 4 on your sheet, please. This is right after the story of King David and his son Absalom. Absalom. Anyone familiar with that story? What's the story? Briefly? He was caught in a tree. What was he doing in a tree? Absalom, he was caught by his hair, right? But what came before that? There's a whole story before that, right? He rebelled. He tried to take the throne from his father. Absalom, right? Was it Dryden who wrote Absalom and Achitophel? Absalom and Achitophel? I think so. In any case, Absalom rebelled against his father, tried to take the throne. He was wildly popular until he died. But after that, this is right after that, we get the following story. And to that place was called Simon, a wicked man, and his name was Sheva ben Bichri of Benjamin. And he blew a shofar and he declared, "We have no portion in David, no lot in the son of Jesse, Yishai, each to his own tent, Israel. This man from the tribe of Benjamin says, I'm going to lead a secession. We are seceding from the Jewish people. It matters that he's from the tribe of Benjamin. Because who was King David's predecessor? King Saul, who was from the tribe of Benjamin. So monarchy has left the tribe of Benjamin and gone to the tribe of Judah. This fellow is from the tribe of Benjamin. He says, we want it back. We have no interest." And this is part of a long history, a split which would become relevant 2 generations after this story, the split between the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judea. But we're not going to go there right now. The point is, this fellow, Sheva ben Bichri, starts a revolt against King David and an attempt for Benjamin and their allies to secede from the Jewish people. And all Israel, that's been what will become later the northern kingdom, think north of Jerusalem, basically, in the land, ascended from behind David to follow Sheva ben Bichri. And the Judeans, in Jerusalem and point south, clung to their king from the Jordan River to Jerusalem. So here you have a rift. Now, I'm not giving you the whole Sheva ben Bichri story. Sheva ben Bichri ends up being holed up in a city, and David's forces are besieging the city, and an older woman in the city says, "Hold off, don't attack." She kills Sheva ben Bichri, and that ends the siege without further bloodshed. But there is a price to be paid for this. And the price to be paid continues in the next part of the excerpt. This picks up in chapter 24 of the book. The chapters in between 20 and 24 have various they have stories and songs from previous times in the reign of David. And then we get this story. And God's anger continued to burn against Israel. And he, God, she if you like, but then you have to pay Satan also. And he persuaded David upon them, saying, go count Israel and Judea. He said, I want you to go count Israel and Judea. Anything wrong with that? You're not supposed to count people. So we're going to come back to this. We have a tradition of not counting people. You'll see more about this momentarily. Let's get the story first. And the king said to Joab, the general with him, travel now among all the tribes of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, and count the nation, and I will know the census of the nation. Joab doesn't want to do it. Joab said to the king, may Hashem, your God, double the nation repeatedly, 100-fold, and may my master, the king, see it. Why does my master want this? He says, you count, generally speaking, because you want to see growth, you want to see how much you have. May it continue to grow, may it double and double and double again, may you see a great and mighty nation, but don't make me count them. Why does my master, the king, want this? But the king's word was strong to Joab and to the military officers, and Joab and the military officers departed from before the king to count the nation Israel. And in fact, the story leads to tragedy. That's the version of the story that you see here. And then it continues. I thought I had brought another verse, but I forgot to insert it. But in the verse that I did not bring, which would be chapter 24, sentence 10, David acknowledges that he has sinned. So in this version of the story, there was a rebellion against David. The northern kingdom wants to secede. David manages to defeat the rebellion. David then, in the next story that we have, tells his general to count the nation. General doesn't want to do it. David says, you're doing it. He says, okay, boss. But now take a look at source number 5. You see, this story is told twice biblically. Once in the part we just read. The other in the book of Chronicles, which recaps many events from David's time. But here the story is told differently. In source number 5, and a Satan arose upon Israel, and he persuaded David to count Israel. In source number 4, who was it who persuaded David to count? God. In source number 5, it's Satan who is persuading David. And the idea here, which we're going to come back to, is Satan is fundamentally just an agent of God. Unlike the Christian version, in which Satan is freelancer, here, he's on the payroll. God gets Satan to convince David to do the census. But as we said, we're not supposed to count people. We have a tradition of not counting people. Yes?
Is that why my friend that is very orthodox will not tell me how many grandchildren
she has? Possibly, yes. Possibly, yes. There are two reasons why she might not tell you that. One reason that's given for not doing that is this. The other is because in general it's considered if you show off your good fortune to somebody else, you invite jealousy upon yourself. So that's a separate issue. But both could be involved, yes.
So if we're not supposed to count, why do we have to count 10 men for the
Indiana? Oh,
so one friend will do like not one, not two, not three.
Right. So one version of it, which I saw as a kid, it always struck me as a little bit odd. Not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, as though you're putting one over on it. Like if you're not supposed to count, you're not supposed to count. Another approach is indeed to count objects related to them. We're going to actually see that. Might as well take a look at it now. In source number 6. In source number 6, you find King Saul counting his troops twice, but he doesn't count heads. Rather, he counted them the first time, it says, with shards, some pieces of pottery, distributed the pieces of pottery, and then counted the pieces of pottery. And then the other time, he counted them with sheep. This is not counting sheep. He assigns each one a sheep, and then the total is, the number of people. The earliest source for this is the Torah's account of the Hashemah. Right? When the Jews are in the wilderness after they left Egypt, and they are counted, each one contributes a half shekel coin, and you count out how many you have, and that's how you get it. There is one other thing that people do in order to count. They take a verse which has 10 words in it, and they'll say it as they go through the people. So there's one, Mashiach et amecho v'reth ba'alatecha. Another one is the blessing on bread has 10 words in it. So people will use that. Yes, that's exactly where I was going. Is the question for why? The general approach is that we don't count individuals because it's like you're separating them from the community. In other words, counting people, identifying this one, and this one, and this one separately, and we believe that there's merit in being part of the community, not being singled out. So therefore, we don't identify people as separate individuals. There are other explanations, naturally. Yeah, we're happy to provide more explanations. But the point is that David is carrying out a census. And we know since the Jews left Egypt that you don't do that. You count people with the shekel coin, with the pottery shard, with the sheep, whatever it is. And it's clearly known in David's time because he sold it. So why does David do the census? Take a look at the Talmud in source number 7, in which this is, God speaking to David. I am going to cause him to sin in something which even school children know. Everybody knows that you're not supposed to count, says the Talmud. And God is deliberately leading him into an error via the Satan. So the question is, so how could he make that mistake? Rabbi Meir Leibush, author of the Malbim commentary to Tanakh, offers a very interesting explanation. I brought it for you in source number 8. He says it goes back to that rebellion of Sheba ben Bichri, which had really spooked King David. When he, David, saw that they had abandoned him following Sheba ben Bichri, he no longer trusted them to gather at his command in a time of war. He's afraid. Who do I have on my side? He has his son rebelled and took a good chunk of the nation with him. Sheba ben Bichri rebelled and almost led a secession of the north. Right? If he hadn't been executed by the woman in that city, who knows what would have happened? And David says, I'm afraid that I can't lead. He wished to count them and to record the names of the warriors in the record books so that each would be bound to enter the army in a time of war. To draft. This was the persuasion and urging, for Israel truly were whole with him. So in other words, this is how Satan convinces David that he has to count the people, that he has to violate this principle of not engaging in a census. And that's what causes David's ultimate vulnerability and the suffering that comes from this further on in the text. By the way, you should know, this issue of not counting comes up every time they want to do a census in Israel. There are those who will not participate in the census because of this principle.
Rabbi, how yes. Do they manage when they're going into the army? How do they know how many are in the army, coming in the army?
Right. And yes, there are other ways that you can count without counting people individually. The question was, how do you deal with it in practice in the in the army? But the answer is there are ways to take care of this. Counting groups and so on, it can be handled. And it is generally speaking. But that's our first story. The role of the Satan is to say to David, you are not suited to lead this army, they won't follow you. That's story number one. Story number two, the story of Job. Now, the book of Job has 42 chapters. I taught a weekly class on it a while back at Shari Shamayim, and it took us 2 years. So we are not going to go through the entire story right now. But what's the basics of the story of Job? You want to learn it? There's Satan in it. He's an honorable man. Satan tells
Job.
Tells Job. Satan does not speak to Job. Satan speaks to God. What does he say?
He's going to force Job to do evil.
He wants to get Job to betray God. And that's really the story in a nutshell. Take a look, please, at source number 9. I should note that there's a debate among Jewish sages as to whether this story ever happened or whether it's a parable. But for our purposes, it doesn't matter. The book of Job begins with a few verses that describe the righteousness of Job and of his family, as well as his great wealth and his great fortune. He has children who get along with each other, they eat each other's houses, they're pious, they have everything they could possibly want. With that in mind, take a look at source number 9. The day came when the sons of God came to stand before God. Sons of God, I put in quotes, we generally understand that to mean some form of angels up in the heavens. They came to stand before God, and the Satan also arrived among them. And God said to the Satan, "Where are you coming from?" And the Satan answered God, saying, "From traveling over the earth and walking in it." And God said to the Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him in the land, a simple and an upright man, one who reveres God and turns away from evil." Why did you do that, God? What made you say that to him? You asked him where he's been. He told you he's been around traveling, and you had to go point out Job, and you had to go praise Job. What is going on in this story? It's a very strange conversation. Take a look at source number 10. There's an edition of Tanakh, which I find very helpful. And they have on each book of Tanakh the edition of Tanakh is called Dan Mikra, and the volume on the book of Job is edited by Professor Amos Chacham. So he wrote what I'm now going to show you in source number 10. He was from Hebrew U, I believe. He says Satan did not name a particular place from which he had come. He didn't say, "I've been hanging out in, you know, Jerusalem, or Eilat, or Russia, or whatever." He didn't say that. He said, "I've been all over the world." Apparently, he meant to say, "I have not come to inform of a particular sin performed in one place. Rather, the whole land is filled with sin, for there are no righteous people on earth." He says, this is the way he reads the story. What Satan has said to God is not, "I've been traveling everywhere," but rather, "I can go wherever I want. Business is good." When you're Satan, you're welcome everywhere. That's what he says to God. Which makes sense now of God's response. God says to him, Job is not vulnerable to you. Job is righteous. He does everything he's supposed to do. He's perfect. Now let's go back into source number 9, the top line on the second side. And the Satan answered God, saying, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not protected him in his house and all that he has everywhere?" Right? You took care of him. You gave him whatever he could possibly want. "You have blessed the work of his hands. His property has spread in the land. Send forth your hand and touch all that he has, and he will," quote, "bless you to your face." Blessing in Tanakh is sometimes a euphemism for cursing. What he's saying is, Job will blaspheme if you take away all the things you've given him. And God said to the Satan, "Behold, all that he owns is in your hand. But do not send forth your hand against him. Don't harm him physically." And the Satan departed from before God, and the story plays out as it does. Satan's charge about Job, is what? What's he really saying?
That Job has it easy, so he doesn't have anything to be said about it.
Job has it easy.
Job had everything, and that's why he could be so righteous.
Job had everything, and every righteous. Yeah.
Once he's tried, or he will not remain righteous.
Right. Once he's tested, he will not remain righteous. What he's really saying, I mean, all the things you said, are, I think, are correct. What he's saying is, I guess someone back there said that nobody is perfect. But more than nobody is perfect, what he's saying is that all human beings, even the so-called best of them, are selfish.
Or can be tempted.
Can be tempted, but it's not about being tempted. No temptation is ever put in front of Job. The only thing that's done is to make him suffer. It's that when people find that their loyalty to God doesn't bring them prizes, they stop being loyal to God. The book begins as a trial of humanity. Where it goes is Job turns it into a trial of God. How could you do this? But it begins as a trial of humanity. Can human beings be loyal to God when they don't get what they want? That's what this is about. Satan's charge to Job, or regarding Job, since he doesn't speak to Job directly, but Satan's charge to Job is, you can't be truly righteous. It's not in human nature. All that righteousness is a facade. It's because you get what you want. Yeah?
I think about the word that I did not come to inform of a particular sin.
Yes.
The word particular, does that mean that the Satan was just spreading all over and looking all over the nation to look for particular sin?
Maybe.
Or just, I'm here to do whatever I want and nobody has a power over me.
So good question. What it sounds like here is that he is reporting something about humanity, and what he's saying is, I'm not here because, you know, John in Kazakhstan did something wrong, or Jill in Washington did something wrong. I am here to tell you that they all do things wrong. That's what he's trying to say to God. And yeah, part of his role is this reporting role. We'll see more about it as we flesh this out. But I want to go through the third story now. We have two stories so far. King David and Job. Satan tells King David, you can't lead. Satan tells Job, you can't read. He doesn't tell him, he doesn't speak to him. But he conveys the message that Job cannot be righteous. And then we go to our third story. And the third story involves the prophet Zechariah and a man by the name of Yehoshua or Joshua. This is not the more famous Joshua, the one who brought the Jews into the land of Israel after Moses died. This is not that Joshua, this is another Joshua. Later in Jewish history. Specifically, we're now in the beginning of the Second Temple period. 5th century, roughly, before the Common Era. The Jews had a temple. It was destroyed by the Babylonians. They were exiled by the Babylonians. The Persians conquered the Babylonians. The Persians let the Jews come back to their land and build a temple. And the Jews of this time are led by several political leaders. One is Zerubbabel, another one is Sheshbazzar. But the key leader for our story is Yehoshua Kohen Gadol, Joshua the high priest. He is the one who runs things in this new temple, the new Beit HaMikdash, that the Jews have built. The prophet who we're going to talk about is named Zechariah. And Zechariah has a vision, which we actually read traditionally as the Haftorah on Hanukkah. So Hanukkah is not that far off. You can keep it in mind for then. Zechariah has a vision. In general, Zechariah is the sort of prophet who sees really pure visions, meaning the early prophets, many of them got direct messages from God. They didn't see pictures of things. For Zechariah, it's generally pictures or action scenes that he sees and that he needs to interpret. So look at this in source number 11, from chapter 3 in Zechariah. And he here is an angel who is sort of Zechariah's guide in his vision. He showed me Joshua the high priest, standing before a malach of God. Malach is an angel, but I don't like the word angel. I think we've discussed this on other occasions. The word angel is from the Greek, and I don't think it conveys the same idea as malach. Malach is an entity that carries out a task for God. The term for task in Hebrew being melacha, a malach is an agent of melacha. And malach is a being that carries out a task for God. Whether it's a spiritual being, whether it be like celestial, whether it's a human being, whether it's a physical object. As Maimonides said, a drop of rain can be a malach as well. That's why I don't like translating malach as angel if I can avoid it. So, he sees Joshua the high priest standing before a malach of God. And the Satan stood on his right to obstruct him. So this is our third appearance of Satan. And God said to the Satan, God rebukes you, Satan. And God rebukes you, the one who has chosen Jerusalem. Meaning God is the one who has chosen Jerusalem. He rebukes the Satan. Is this not a brand rescued from the flames? The brand that he's referring to, rescued from the flames, is either a reference to the Jews who have come back to build the second temple, or Joshua the high priest. But he says, the Satan is trying to do something to Joshua, and God says, I'm going to protect Joshua because he is like a brand rescued from the flames. Are we clear? I know this story is not that familiar to people, so I want to make sure that we get it right. And Joshua was clothed in filthy clothing and standing before the Malach. And God declared to those standing before him, remove the filthy clothing from him. And he told him, behold, I have removed your sin from you and clothed you in fresh clothing. Is that story at all clear? No, it's not. By the way, interesting note, the Satan is standing on Zechariah's right. From this comes the practice of the person who blows shofar on Rosh Hashanah, blowing out of the right side of his mouth. In other words, you hold the shofar like this properly. If you can't, then you can blow from the left. But the idea is the Satan is standing on the right, and you're doing battle with the Satan via the shofar blast. That's the image. So, and again, we have to come back to the whole Satan shofar thing that we talked about with the 30-30-40. But the image here is of a Satan trying to do something to Joshua the high priest, Yoshua Kohen Gadol, and being blocked by God. God says, no, you don't get to do that. What's the image of the filthy clothing? Sin. How do you know?
He says,
well, remove the filthy clothing and the sin. Right? He says there, I have removed your sin from you and clothed you in fresh clothing.
But it doesn't say how he got to be clothed in filthy clothing.
Correct. Doesn't say how he got there. So.
And what was his sin?
So, Rashi, the classic commentator, as well as others, said that the sin that we're talking about was the sin of Joshua's family. Because we find Joshua's children in the book of Ezra, in Tanakh, involved in a sin. It's in Ezra chapter 10. And this dirty clothing represents the guilt that he bears for the sins of his family, as alleged by the Satan. Satan charges that Joshua is unfit to serve as the high priest, to serve in the temple. He says, you're guilty of sin. You can't serve. And God says, you don't dare touch him. He is a brand who has emerged from the fire. He has gone through the worst. And you can't condemn him. And in fact, he is worthy. And so he rebukes the Satan, and he says, remove the filthy clothing, give him fresh clothing, because the sin is not on his record. That's the story. Clear? So we now have three stories of Satan in Tanakh. These are the only three times in Tanakh where Satan appears as a as a personality, as opposed to the verb l'satan being used to obstruct. So what can we learn from here regarding the nature and the role of Satan? Well, first of all, he's an agent of God. He works for God. How do you know that? How do you know that he works for God?
God speaks to him.
God speaks to him, but that doesn't mean he works for God. You can speak to someone who's not your employee. Yeah.
He tells him what to do.
Tells him what to do. Right? In that story with King David, we saw one version in which he said God convinced King David, the other version that it's Satan who actually does the job. God has outsourced it. He said, Satan, I want you to take care of this. In the story with Job, right, these malachim, these heavenly beings, sons of God, are before God, and in comes the Satan to file a report. In this story here, with Joshua, the high priest, God tells him what to do. He says, you don't get to carry out your actions against him. That doesn't really mean he's an employee. That could theoretically have been an opponent. That is not necessarily proof. But in each case, Satan's mission is consistent. What's the common denominator between what Satan does to David, what Satan does to Job, and what Satan does to Joshua? What's common to all three? It's not temptation. Again, there's no tempting of Job. He doesn't give him any prizes. Sorry? Jealousy? What do you mean?
Jealous of the performances that they have. They have that relationship with God that he does.
Interesting. Is he jealous of them? That could be. We're going to come back to something that might reflect that as well. But what is it that he tries to do?
He's exposing them to God.
He's exposing them to God, meaning?
Meaning he's showing them that they aren't as good as God thinks they are.
They're not as great as God thinks they are. His job is to condemn. His job is to find weakness. Yes, you were going to say?
I was going to say to diminish their abilities, their leadership.
Right, to diminish their abilities.
Bring them down.
To bring them down. That's the job of Satan. Satan says David can't lead. He's going to get David to make a mistake by undermining his confidence. In Job, he doesn't speak to Job. But what he does is he takes everything away from him in order to create that distance between Job and God. He's undermining him. He takes away Job's family. Job thinks they're dead. He takes away all of Job's wealth. He even takes away his friends. Right? The friends come to Job and they speak to him in harsh ways in throughout the book. And then with Joshua, the high priest, as well. The image is, Joshua is not fit to serve. His job is to claim humanity cannot be righteous. That's also consistent with the name Satan. I mentioned in the beginning that the word Satan itself means to obstruct. He is the one who obstructs. We even have it in Midrashim, where the sages expand the activities of the Satan. Anyone familiar with the role of Satan in the Akedah, the binding of Isaac? Sound familiar at all? In the biblical text, there is no role. We don't find any reference to him. However, the Midrash, building on scriptural references here and there, the Midrash has the idea that Abraham actually, and Isaac, are blocked by a river on their way to the Akedah, on the way to the binding of Isaac, and the river is simply Satan blocking their way, trying to get them not to do what God wants them to do. The Jews around Har Sinai, around Mount Sinai, after they had already received the Ten Commandments, Moses went up and out, and he's there for 40 days. He's not coming down. They know he didn't bring up any food. They know he didn't bring up any water. And they're wondering what has happened to him. And, of course, how did that story end? They make the golden calf. They say, we broke the last leader. We need a new one. Right? That's what they do. They go to Aaron. Aaron brought them Moses out of the wilderness. And they say, we lost him. Can you replace him? And they end up with a golden calf. Says the Midrash there, again, building on hints in the biblical verses, but there's nothing explicit there. The people saw a vision of Moses' dead body on a funeral bed. How do they see it? Satan shows them this vision that Moses is now dead, and that therefore they're not going to be able to fulfill their divine mission. This is what he does. This is what Satan does. And it's a devastating mission. Right? I mean, he's alongside Malach HaMoves, right? The angel of death. And the Yetzer Hara was trying to get people to sin actively by tempting them. And his job is to claim that you can't be righteous. I brought you a passage from the Talmud regarding somebody by the name of Elisha ben Avuya, also known as Acher. Anyone here read As a Driven Leaf? Okay. Someone has read As a Driven Leaf years ago. Okay, I'm not going to test you on it. Elisha ben Avuya was one of the great sages of the time of the Mishnah. He was a colleague of, among others, Rabbi Akiva. He was the mentor of one of the greatest sages of that time, Rabbi Meir. And he also was a mirror of Greek philosophy. And at a certain point, his faith in God was shaken, and he walked away. But then you get this passage in the Talmud about this, about his story. He heard a bat kol, a small voice. And the voice called out, return wayward children, except for Acher. Shuvu banim shovavim chuzme Acher in the Hebrew. Acher was the name that he became known as. What does Acher mean in Hebrew? What's Acher? Other. He becomes known as the Other. Because he has left everything, he becomes known as the Other. And everybody can return, but you can't. To which he said, since I am chased away from that world, from the heavens, I shall go enjoy this world. I guess I'll go have a good time here. Right? If I can't get into heaven anyway, so, you know, might as well enjoy myself here rather than suffer in two worlds. But the point is, it takes away his hope when he is undermined in terms of the belief of his own righteousness and his own power to be good and to be recognized as good. Then at that point, he simply walks away. That's the job of Satan in all of our stories, is to do that. Here's an interesting thing about it. On the one hand, this is a mission from God. Right? This is what he's charged to do. We all have jobs. Right? Some of us might be teachers, some of us might be plumbers, and, you know, Satan's mission is, okay, your job is to go undermine people. On one hand, I understand. It's a challenge. Right? We weren't put into this world in order to have an easy time of things. We're being tested. On the other hand, the way the sages speak of this is that this mission that he has, bless you, is a mission that is abhorrent to God. He is the one who's going to carry out, Satan is going to carry out what God told him to do, but God doesn't like it, even though he requires it of him. I'll give you an example. Take a look at Maimonides in source number 13. Maimonides points out something fascinating about what we saw in source number 9. If you jump back to number 9, beginning of number 9 for a moment. That story began with, the day came when the sons of God came to stand before God, and the Satan also arrived among them. Maimonides picked up on that, and he said, you notice that Satan's not part of the rest of the group. He stands apart. He wasn't invited. He's a party crasher. It did not say that B'nai HaElokim, the sons of God, and the Satan came to stand before God, which would have indicated that all were in one relationship as equals. Rather, it said, and the sons of God, the B'nai HaElokim, came to stand before God, and the Satan was also among them. Language like this is stated only regarding someone who was not intended or invited personally. When the intended parties came, he mixed into the group as well. He's a party crasher. God says, I need someone to do this, but I really don't like it. And so therefore, he's not in with everybody else. Yeah?
In Hebrew, is the
fun
Hasatan?
So in two out of the three cases I gave you, he is Hasatan, Job, and Zechariah. In the one with King David, the hey isn't there. It isn't the Satan, is just and Satan persuaded. By Yaset Satan is the Hebrew.
So is there any consideration that this is a title for a particular angel rather than, like, if you say Satan, it's a name, it's like
yeah.
God, but when you say that, then it's the role rather than.
Interesting. So I have seen it argued the opposite way. The question is, maybe when you say the Satan, it means whoever it is who's playing a particular role, as opposed to an Satan, which is a name. Right? So my name is Mordecai, so you would say and Mordecai, you wouldn't say and the Mordecai, unless it was the person who's playing this role at this moment in time, the rabbi, whatever. Right. So actually, it's funny, because the commentators who discuss this usually make the opposite argument. They argue that in the David story, Vayaset Satan, they say that is just God doing the persuading, and he's acting as a Satan to him. Whereas when it's the, they usually argue that that means, no, it's a specific being. So I think what that means to me is that you could argue it both ways. I think it's an interesting distinction, but I think you could argue it both ways. But the way Maimonides looks at this is that Satan is essentially a necessary evil. It's needed. There has to be someone who can do this. But it's not beloved to God. It's actually anathema. Yeah.
That most things in math are meant to teach us something that is broader than the particular details.
You bet.
And so if God is, if man is made in the image
of God. I'm going to repeat it, don't worry.
Yeah. If man is made in the image of God, and we struggle with right and wrong, and we have an example of God also struggling with right and wrong, and so there is something, well, not okay with it, but we are like in the image that in the way we come to be in this world, there is this challenge, and we have to deal with it and live with it and do the best we just can.
Very much so. So the point made is that man is created, we're told, in the image of God. If we struggle with a Satan, and we struggle with good and bad, then does that mean that God struggles with good and bad, and that we're being told this is part of our mission in this world? Yes, this is here, and you have to learn to deal with it. Right? That's an accurate representation, sort of?
Yes, but it just shows that it's not like bad, or you're punished, or this is the nature of our existence. It's sort of like life and death.
We
come and then we die, and this.
Right. So the issue is that it's a necessary part of life. This is what you have to deal with. So I would say a couple of things. First, I'm just looking at the time and realizing I'm going to have to condense it a little bit. But first, this idea of God dealing with this is already in Parshat Bereishit, in the beginning of the Torah, when we eat from the fruit of knowledge of good and evil, which isn't just about knowledge of it, but it's intimacy with good and evil. It's been internalized. And not, remember, in the beginning of the Torah, speaks about not just knowledge objectively, but intimacy. And God says, now, he's like us. Us, the divine of us. Meaning, it says, he knows, is intimate with good and evil. Animals don't know from good and evil. They're not making a moral judgment. Human beings are now in the realm of having an affinity for right and wrong. and needing to make that decision. So I hear what you're saying in that regard. I wouldn't trace it back to the image of God for other reasons. But I think it is there, this idea that we have this. And yes, it's part of what we have to deal with. I'm recognizing that we have like 5 minutes left. So at this point, I think I'm going to take over in order to get through a couple of key elements here. I brought you in sources number 14 and 15. You can see it for yourself later on. But these are two midrashim, one brought in the Talmud, one brought in the volume Bereishit Rabba, which speak about God deciding to create the universe and polling the malachim, polling his celestial beings about creating us. And in the first version of it, they say, no, God, you shouldn't create man. And God says, off with your head, let's ask a new bunch of angels. Meaning, God recognizes the problems that we're going to have with Satan and says, nonetheless, I want there to be human beings. In number 15 in the Midrash, God rigs the election. Right? When there's a voter against creating human beings, God throws out the voter. That's the way that God deals with this. He wants us to exist. He doesn't like having to undermine us, even if it is necessary for the plan. Now, the result of this is that it plays a major role for us come Rosh Hashanah time. I talked about shofar in the beginning. Right? We talked about blowing the shofar to confuse the satan. There are actually a whole bunch of practices that we have. I shorthanded it in source number 16. I gave you some examples of it, which speak to this. The tradition of blessing the new month in the synagogue before, on the Shabbat before the new month, isn't done on the Shabbat before Rosh Hashanah. Why? According to some, to confuse the satan. We blow the shofar in the synagogue every day of the month of Elul, leading up to Rosh Hashanah, except the last one. The 29th day of Elul, we don't blow the shofar. Why? To confuse the satan. There are all sorts of practices like that. Why at that time of year? Because we are promised purification on Yom Kippur if we repent. We need the confidence that we are able to do so. And the satan is that force that's going to say, you can't do it, you've repented every year, it never works, don't bother. And so that's the time that we are concerned about defeating that which would undermine us. And you ask, well, does that really confuse the satan? I mean, blowing the shofar out of the right side, so you get the satan, blowing the shofar before Musaf and during Musaf. So, you could say, well, maybe Satan's just not very smart. Or you could look at it and say that some of these rituals are meant to take the root of lying low. If I don't play up my desire to change, if I don't announce Rosh Hashanah is coming on the Shabbat beforehand, if I stop blowing shofar for a day, then that voice inside me that says, you can't do this, won't be awakened until it's too late. That's one way to look at it. There's more to be said. Maybe I'm going to leave that because I don't want to do it. I'd rather not do it improperly or incompletely. But the message that I see here is to look at these three stories. And this goes back to your question about everything in Tanakh is there to teach us something. Because there's one other common denominator between each of these stories. Besides the role of Satan in terms of trying to undermine, the other common denominator is that Satan loses in each of the three stories. In the story of King David and the census, David failed. He did count the Jews. And in fact, if you read that chapter in Tanakh, you find that there is suffering as a result. But at the end of that chapter, he buys a threshing floor. And he builds an altar. And that altar becomes the altar for the future Beit HaMikdash, the future temple. David is told you're not allowed to build the temple itself, but he builds the Mizbeach, the altar on which we would end up bringing our gifts for God. Job is pushed almost to the breaking point, but he doesn't break. And in the end, he wins a conversation with God. He gets his family back. He is identified by God as the righteous victor in that battle that goes on. And Joshua, Yoshua, the Kohen Gadol, the high priest, we saw it. God rebukes the Satan, and then orders the Malach to give Joshua pure, clean clothing befitting his righteousness. In each case that Satan appears in Tanakh, it is as the losing party. And the lesson for us, I think, is not to listen to the voice that says, you can't. If you fail, you can come back, just like David did. If you push, you can withstand it, as Job did. And even if we lack the strength, as in the case of Joshua the high priest, God is going to be there for us, as he was there for him. So to me, that's a quick guide to the role of Satan in Tanakh. I will be back, God willing. When is my next one? Do you know? I don't
know.
Either November or December. I know that. December 5th. So I look forward to seeing you then. I will mention, in case anyone is interested in availability.